Okay, then thank you very much. So, hands shooting up at the back there with Bill.
I'll go first for a change. Very interesting talk about how to agree and tell you the distinction between science, natural sciences in English, and the German understanding. But just a point about, or question around, I mean, the whole edifice of Marxist capital rests on one unproven axiom that all commodities have to have something in common in order to compare them. Now, that might seem as it's obvious, but that's something he doesn't even try and prove. That's just, and the whole thing dies with that premise. And likewise, one of the ideas that largely accepted among party speakers, and then this came to my mind when you were speaking, is the case that the burden of taxation cannot fall on wages and salaries. Because if the capitalist state does manage to, because the actual real wage is your take-home wage, and if the capitalist state manages to reduce your wage to increase taxation, that's it really snatching the money that your employer would otherwise have taken from you soon. Or if your wage then goes up to compensate, that just proves that there's a real take-home pay and that the market force between employer and employee. So it's really always snatching money from the employer. Well, it's really particularly well, but the point is that is also absolutely immune to empirical proof, but it is built on a series of premises which seem to indicate very strongly that it is correct. So there's just as a distinction between the natural scientific approach and we have to do sciences in the broader political science spectrum.
Okay,
I'll only answer that quickly by saying that in other sciences as well, there are objects that can't be directly observed. There are hypothetical objects in physics that form part of the best explanation that incorporates lots of other facts, but you might not be able to see them going down the accelerator individually. Similarly in art history, the vanishing point where parallel lines meet is a hypothetical theoretical object, which you can't directly observe. And probably in any science, you'll find that there are some things that are clearly there, other things that form part of the best theory you've got that accounts for the facts that you can see.
Okay, anyone else? Brian.
Yeah, thank you, it was a very interesting talk, very interesting. When you were talking, two books came to mind, two books. One, there was a book by a Dutch chap called Gendeloos, and he wrote a real critique of non-violence. He said non-violence was not a thing to be followed. It was bad, it was really bad. Basically, it supported government, it supported the state, and it was very, very bad. And he kind of quotes it with somebody like Ashoka, who became a Buddhist, of course, and he became a Buddhist, and he instituted Buddhism as an ideology because it was non-violent. And of course, it supported the government, the one of the early kingdoms, right? That's it. And he also, you know, he talked about that a lot of empires always talked about themselves as being peaceful. So you have the Pax Britannica, that the government had actually created a situation which was peaceful and non-violent. So Gendeloos was arguing against this whole idea of non-violence. The other book suddenly came to mind, which you've probably never heard of, but there's a very famous naturalist called W.H. Hudson. And in the 19th century, he was born in, he lived in Argentina. And in Argentina, in the 19th century, was pretty, with the gauchos, everything was fairly wild, actually. There was no government, as it were. And then it was, in Argentina, you've got a real dictator, Rosa, who was called Rosa, who created peace, who created the situation of order, non-violence, peaceful and whatnot. And Hudson, who was a naturalist, he wasn't a political figure, he thought to himself, well, which is worse, actually? Which is worse? The original situation, which are pretty wild on the pampas of South America, or what was reckoned was peaceful, but actually the peaceful wasn't very peaceful at all with Rosa. It was a violent government that was established, as it were. And when you're talking, I had this thing of democracy between, on the one hand, you've got kind of violent conflict, and on the other hand, you've got a situation where everybody thinks the same, and there's complete consensus, and you know, everybody puts their hand up, and sees democracy as actually between these two extremes. On the one hand, peace and non-violence, and the other hand, you know, coercion, violence, and conflict. And that democracy is a way that accepts that we are actually conflicting in a way that we have disagreements, we don't always think the same, we have arguments. Just like you're saying, there's a kind of dialectic going on. It's between these two extremes. It's just as these two books came into my head as you were talking.
Thank you, Brian. Paddy first, Jordan.
Yeah, thanks for that. That was interesting. I've got to confess that I'm a little bit confused. I'm a bit puzzled. I wasn't really quite sure what you were saying. I thought at first you were going to say that there is a multiplicity of views about Marx and Marxism. So there's a sort of diversity, an organic diversity of views on that. And that's good and that's quite productive. And I thought, okay, yeah, I'll go on with that. Then you were talking about diversity of views in future society and in socialism, and how everyone's not going to be a sort of robot. And I was thinking, fine, but why are you saying that? I mean, is there anybody who's in sort of genuine revolution who really thinks we're all going to be androids? And then the last thing I thought was, are you saying that, what's the word, pluralism? Are you saying that pluralism is always good, or would you accept that there are certain situations where the pluralism, in fact, you were talking about physics, and the analogy that came to my mind was the uncertainty principle, and where ideas can be everywhere, but at a certain point, the wave function collapses, and it's at one fixed point, and that's the end of that thing. And why I was thinking that was, supposing you've got a group of friends and you all want to go on holiday, but you can't agree where to go. One person wants to go to Spain, one person wants to go to Greenland, one person wants to go to North Korea. There's your uncertainty, there's your plurality. But until that collapses into a definite decision, the end of pluralism, none of you get to move. And it seems to me that this is where the communist or the socialist revolutionary movement is. It can't decide where it wants to go. And it isn't the case. And you said early on that, you know, this is a future society we all want. My immediate thought was, is it though? Is it? I'm not really sure, because I've talked to a lot of, you know, groups on the left, Trots and Leninists, and it doesn't sound to me like that's what they want. It sounds to me like they want North Korea, and I am not going along with those people under any circumstances. They don't want to go on holiday to the same place I do. So, do you see what I'm saying? That sort of pluralism is not necessarily very healthy, and it does need to be resolved. And it doesn't make you a dogmatist to say, this is a destination we want. We don't want that place. We want this place, and this is how we think we should go about getting there. In other words, you want to go to Spain, you want to fly, you don't want to walk. That sort of thing. I don't think that's dogmatic to say that. See what I mean? So I'm not quite sure what to take from your message about pluralism.
Thanks. Couple of points there, and probably I was not very clear in the introduction. I think the point about the group of people who are deciding to go somewhere on holiday or whatever it might be, that's where democracy comes in, that even if we haven't finally decided, and even if somebody still thinks that actually, wouldn't Iceland be better? They've got hot springs in Iceland. then you still accept that we'll do what the we'll do what the majority decides. Of course, nothing in, or very little in science is ever completely, definitively, firmly established, so it could never be reopened. Newtonian mechanics was extremely firmly established, and people 150 years ago or whatever would have thought, well, certainly the laws of Newton we will never reopen. But in fact, they did get reopened and re-examined. That's a slight sidetrack, possibly. Differences of destination and differences of route is a very important point, and perhaps I was guilty of muddling those two up, but in principle they shouldn't be. In principle, I think you're completely right. That if it's easy to get into an argument with somebody about, I think we should go this way and I think we should go that way, and in fact you're trying to get to completely different destinations. But that, up to a point, only emerges in the conversations or in the debates that you've said that you've had. That you find out that you and they were talking at cross purposes, and that's a clarifying step that if you only read their stated slogans, you might not have got to.
Simon?
Yeah, firstly, as an reply to comments on non-violence, I think we need to be very clear that, let's start with, there's a Dirty Harry quote that says, there's nothing wrong with shooting as long as the right people get shot.
Simon, we have a request. Can you speak up a little, please? So there are some people who can't hear.
I keep thinking I'm talking fine. I don't think it's so there's a Dirty Harry quote. I think it's from Magnum Force, where he says, there's nothing wrong with shooting as long as the right people get shot. Now, we tend to have a, oh, please, no shooting rule. But in fact, anyone who is not arguing for the working class to take control of the state's means of violence as quickly as possible is trying to get us all shot in a football stadium. It's that simple. They will kill us. Yeah? We know this from several events before, even when people are trying to get reforms, yeah, from Chile to wherever. So we need to defend ourselves, and we can't take a sort of like religious, I don't know if you're taking a religious position, but we absolutely cannot take a that kind of position. It would just get us killed. The second minor tactical point about violence is that one of the reasons that that they don't like the working class to be violent is because it makes us opaque in the way that several other things can make us opaque. For example, like having a different religion or a different language that turns us from a set of straight streets into a set of narrow lanes. So there's also that tactical matter of perhaps the say the French in Algiers, they had far more problems policing the place just because of any internal violence before you start talking about revolutionary violence. But that's just a comment on that. I wanted to comment about pluralism as well, back to actually your talk rather than talking sideways. I think there's a matter of, and again, looking at a quote, there's a Bruce Lee quote of, there's a finger pointing at the moon, don't look at the finger, look at the moon, is that the party is, the party is pointing towards the revolution. And as long as you have lots of fairly small parties pointing at the revolution, at what we think is the direction of travel, then that's fantastic. Because you're trying to, you know, look towards, you know, next steps. But the actual organisation or organisations making the revolution have to work in the present, and they just have to inform themselves as best they can to deal with capitalism now. And I think that it's that interplay between you know, organisations that have got more of a more of a programmatic bent, I suppose you'd say, but definitely this is the way to do it. And there's organisations that are pragmatically based that are just saying we need to seize the post office. And there needs to be a balance of the one interacting with the two. And if you have an idea of the one organisation doing both, then you have lost your pluralism. That you can't have, you know, several different strands of thought at the point of trying to make a revolution. You can have an organisation that is fairly inchoate, that doesn't necessarily have revolutionary demands, and the revolutionary demands are coming from outside, from people constantly putting pressure on that organisation, and they can be from various routes. But I don't think you can have a radically different wings of the same organisation that is then engaged in what will be, regardless of the tools involved, a life and death struggle with another class.
Do you want to respond?
I'll respond quickly on the seizing control of the state's means of violence, which obviously, if you frame it in those at that level of generality, then yes, as long as the capitalist class holds the means of violence, then it can exercise it against us. Whether that means that counter-violence, you know, the capitalist class has a nuclear deterrent. I don't think it's plausible that, you know, seizing the post office is one thing, but acquiring our own nuclear weapons and shooting it out with the ruling class by obliterating cities, I don't think is a plausible revolution. I'm a pluralist, but I don't think that's a very plausible revolutionary strategy. In other words, a big chunk of disarming the capitalist class is inevitably going to be political rather than military. It's creating political circumstances, whether it's because the soldiers don't obey the officers or whatever else it might be. But it's going to be political rather than, and this is coming back to that Engels preface that's been discussed in one of the other sessions. But he was talking about, the time of street fighting is much less because now they've got machine guns or something. Well, military technology has advanced very considerably since then. And I think the scope of what you can do by things like seizing the post office has probably diminished as well.
It's just worth pointing out that we don't have to worry about the British ruling class's nuclear deterrent, because they can't use it unless the Americans say they can.
Okay. Kumran?
Thanks, everyone. Really interesting talk. I wonder if you could speak a little bit about, you raised the dialectics. I wonder if you could speak about the dialectical relationship between means and ends. I want to kind of pick up something that Paddy said. I grant that a post-capitalist society would embrace pluralism. It would be like real human pluralism and diversity. But why does that necessarily presuppose that the means to get there, right, in capitalism would have to also be pluralistic? Why would it have to adopt the organizational forms that were unleashed in 19th century capitalism to get over to be in post-capitalism? So that kind of dialectical relationship to means and ends, would you need to be pluralistic now to have a pluralistic post-capitalist society? Is there a direct link there?
When you talk about 19th century, I suppose you're interpreting pluralism in terms of multi-party electoral democracy. And you're taking pluralism to mean it's 19th century now, actually the 18th, you know, with a restricted franchise, but we can have Whigs and Tories. And that's only one particular form, and that's a form that suits the that's a form that suits the capitalist class for how to organise its state, its political parties, its parliament, and so on. Will revolutionaries need to adopt those exact forms? Very probably not. But again, I don't... In practice, there is pluralism because we really don't all agree about things. Democracy, wearing another hat, I'm a sorticianist. I support choosing political representatives by lottery. I think that would be a good way to organise democracy in the future society. And I think it's not a bad way to organise democracy now as well. But I realise that people have, if people want, I can set out the arguments for that. It's not the subject of tonight's meeting, so I don't want to get blown too far off course. I'm mentioning that as an example to say that there are lots of different forms that democracy and pluralism can take. And particular forms might have originated in the 19th century or might have originated in the capitalist epoch. But debate, a clash of different opinions, did not originate with capitalism. And it's difficult to conceive of a healthy organizational life or any kind of healthy interpersonal life without some difference of opinions being argued.
So you started off talking about how you want to make a question about the relationship between the development of science and the practice of politics. So you're kind of talking about how, well, systematically organised knowledge, so Wissenschaft, how this kind of develops through dialogue and this kind of thing, exchange of different views and argument. And then, so you talked about, so pluralism, so I'm thinking, you know, every society has to have politics because value pluralism is a fact of human life, and politics is about how, basically, how societies make and enforce binding decisions when you don't agree, because ethical systems, they're not like facts about the world, they're kind of self-enclosed systems, if you like. So what is the link between how science progresses and the practice of politics, which politics maybe is more like an art, or it's more of a to do with balance of power, you know, interests, these kinds of, some kind of, when I'm talking about politics and value for it, this kind of like the Bernard Williams or Raymond Goyce kind of idea. So it'd be quite nice if you could say how the two parts of your talk are, how you see them related.
They only relate in that both of them require a contest or an interaction of different opinions, mm-hmm. different arguments. In the political side of things, it is also, in fact, different interests, as well as differences of opinion. And in a class society, de facto, those class interests dominate. So politics is relatively little about differences of opinion, although those do exist. And to a great extent, it's about class interests. In any future society, there would continue to be some differences of interest, not major antagonistic differences, but still for the sake of argument, some people would live in the, even if we accept with the Communist Manifesto that the distinction between town and country is abolished, some people will live in the hills and some will live on the coast. and to a certain extent those constitute different interests. So there would always be some differences of interest, not rising to the point of antagonistic class distinction. But politics, whether it's an art, whether it's a science, but democratic politics and science are two examples of activities that require pluralism or debate or small d dialectic. So whether we prefer to think of our politics in one way or the other way, whether we think of it mostly as democratic self-organization or whether we think of it in terms of a scientific understanding. In fact, those are not contradictory. But one of the ways in which they're not contradictory is that from either of them you can argue the need for pluralism.
Okay, Bill.
Come back to Paddy's example. It reminded me of, I think it was also Neurath's distinction between democracy between enemies and democracy between friends. So democracy between enemies is like the robbers in the stagecoach counting up how many guns are on each side, and the one with the fewest guns surrenders. Whereas democracy between friends would be you decided you're going on holiday together, and even if you don't have a majority, or there's someone, a minority, who really, really, really do not want to go to North Korea, you might accede to the minority's wish because you've already decided that you're all going to go together. And that there's, you know, you might be able to tolerate going to Greenland, they will never tolerate going to North Korea. And you know, the minority would, you know, because you know, the greater principle that we're all going on holiday together would be the thing that would win out. And I just thought that's a possibly a couple of different ways of approaching democracy and pluralism.
Okay, Terry?
Yeah, interesting talk about absolute pluralism and things. Bring it back to the real world, you know, you've got shanty towns, you've got crops being produced for the West in countries where people are starving. You've got all that going on. And what would need to happen is the people there would decide what to grow. We might not have so much coffee, or we might not have so many flowers. And that in the world would be a better thing for the people living there. And if it was a socialist world, socialists would understand that. Another thing is you've got experts on science and climate change and things. The informed opinion on climate change is we're in trouble, really, you know. And people would have to bow down to the experts what to do to stop climate change becoming a major problem, especially for some parts of the world that will be underwater soon, really, you know. So all that going on, pluralism is an interesting concept, and I agree that we will have different opinions how to get there, and different opinions when we do get there. But the world is in a mess, right, you know, and there'd be a lot to sort out, right, you know.
George?
Thank you. Bill, yes, I agree, that's a helpful distinction to draw. Completely agree that there is urgency. I'm not recommending purely sitting around arguing for its own sake when there are important things that need to be dealt with. But I mean, yeah, those growers in other parts of the world should and would need to be able to debate among themselves what they're going to grow, and they would need to be part of that democratic process. So I absolutely agree with that. With regard to climate change, I do agree, but I don't think we should I don't think we should in general get swept along into the idea of, you know, we should bow down to the experts, because there are expert economists who would tell you that you need the free market. There are experts in lots of fields, and I think it's often clarifying, rather than talking about experts, to talk about specialists. That These are people who spend more of their time than I do thinking about whatever issue it was. And often I will defer to a specialist, you know, to somebody who knows more than I do, but they're not in principle better than me, and their politics can push them one way or another way. Specialist workers in the field of the climate, it's vital to listen seriously to what they've got to say, which the present social order finds it very difficult to listen seriously to what they've got to say, because as I suggested, pounds and pence are the criterion in capitalist society. But I don't like the phrasing of bow down to the experts. We should take seriously specialists in whatever in whatever field they work in, whether that's climate change or whether it's building a railway track or whether it's doing anything else. There are specialists who've got knowledge that we can all learn from.
Yeah. Simon?
Yeah, I think what's coming through for me is that the key problem in choice is that a choice has a value and a choice has a cost. So what I mean by that is, for example, a choice might have a great deal of value in that it's reassessing the way that we are approaching, say we're talking about the revolution, we're approaching it so that we are coming up with a genuinely better way and safer way of achieving the revolution, and we're far enough away that we're not tripping over our own toes, we're able to organise ourselves towards the new objective. Whereas, for example, if we, if there was an organisation that was already in the process of trying to make a revolution in a rather inchoate way, or a way that we wouldn't appreciate, but if you then presented that same choice, it would have a more limited value because it can't really be executed properly, and it would have a massive cost because it would just cause a rampant confusion. And you can assess choices in that way. For example, where we are at the moment, there's nothing interesting going on. So every choice has virtually no cost. You sort of mean it's not going to matter if you get it wrong. The worst that happens is an organisation of 200-300 people winds up, if you sort of mean. Whereas if you were trying to make that that kind of choice in a much more stressful and consequential situation, it might be something that you just have to say, no, we made that decision 6 months ago, will you just shut up? I don't know if that makes sense to you.
Yes, it does. Maybe take one or two more.
Yeah, no more hands. Anyone else?
Say a word. Your talk wasn't what I thought it was going to be.
Oh dear.
No, it's all right. It's fascinating, actually. That's really fascinating. I didn't think you were going to talk about socialism. I thought you were going to talk about capitalism. The way you framed it was to say that within a socialist society there'd be all sorts of various sort of different choices, and it would be the title of your talk was Marxist pluralism, but it wouldn't be Marxism anymore, wouldn't it? Because people would probably have forgotten about Marx in a socialist society, because there was no longer any need to use his theory or whatever. So It was more mainly about what I would call social pluralism. Okay, nothing wrong with that, social pluralism. And then you said a word or two about how what you're talking about relates to capitalist society. You seem to be saying that we shouldn't be afraid to listen to and have our ideas modified by other organisations which are similar to us, which are saying similar things. So my question really would be, how similar do they have to be? And to what extent, how do we decide to what extent they're worth communicating with, and maybe, you know, seeing whether our ideas can be modified by them. It's a difficult one, because there are all these little organisations that call themselves Marxist and would say they are Marxist. These organisations which are basically exist to support and praise, say, you know, Marxism with a say with Chinese characteristics, and we'd say that's nothing whatsoever to do with Marxism, but they call themselves Marxists. So should we sort of debate with them and try and see whether there's some common ground there? I don't know whether you could sort of say something about and you use the word sortition, I noticed, briefly, and I actually read your piece, your very recent piece on the Corbyn Party on your website. Very interesting as well. You used the term sortition there, I think, didn't you? You were talking about how all sorts of different sort of strands could come together and need to be taken into consideration. So that's what sort of sparked me into wondering, you know, quite the extent to which what you're talking about applies to the current scene within capitalism, rather than what might happen later once we, you know, once we get socialism.
Thank you. It's a very good question, and the answer is going to be completely unsatisfactory. But in the same way that you know whether or not somebody is capable of participating in a useful conversation with you about art history from hearing what they say about paintings and whether it turns out to be nonsense or not. There isn't a cast iron criterion before you engage in the conversation that allows you to say, I can see already. Now, you might. You might know from what they've written on their website or from other things that I know already you're not going to have anything worth saying about art history or about physics or about socialism or about any other area. But in principle, your opinions are open to being modified if the other person says anything that's worth taking seriously. I said it wasn't going to be satisfactory. But I think up to a point that's what we all do. We're all surrounded by lots of people saying different things. And some of them we think are actually... you've got, even if I don't necessarily agree with you, but you're worth taking seriously. You're worth listening to. And you, on the other hand, I'm carefully not gesturing towards anybody in the audience. You, on the other hand, are not worth taking seriously. And I'm not going to bother listening really to anything that you say.
Okay, come on.
I mean, just on that, right, so you described we've already got pluralism in capitalism. So what's the difference in a post-capitalist society? If we can already cooperate with people and use our reason to perhaps reject or accept something, what's the difference in post-capitalist society?
That at the moment we are exploited by the capitalist class, and then we won't be, to put it in simple terms. At the moment, we do not have completely zero freedom of action and freedom of thought and ability to organize. If we had completely zero, we were just totally atomized individuals, then we wouldn't be here debating things with one another and so on. But still, we're living in a society that is dominated by capitalist mode of production and by the logic of the capitalist mode of production. And in a socialist or communist society, that by definition will no longer be true.
Okay, anyone else? How are we doing for time on this?
Half past eight.
Mike, when do we finish?
Well, it's quarter to in there, but obviously as long as the discussion carries on.
Yeah. Okay, you're happy to go ahead. It's fine. Okay, anyone else? Anyone else like to say anything? Bill?
Very quickly. Someone did ask, or mention in discussion earlier about no one is arguing for a post-capitalist society without democracy, but I believe that various stripes of Leninist and Bordigist do, and I think the argument they make is something along the lines of, once we are free from ideology, we'll be able to see reality as it really is, and therefore we will be able to scientifically, rationally decide what needs to be done, therefore we will not need democracy. And I think they do seriously argue there won't be democracy in communism. They'll just be, you know, the organs of whatever we set up to do. We'll just do it, and that's it. So I suppose in terms of what I assume the speaker is arguing against, it's something very like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Anyone else? Sorry, Dan.
Yeah, great.
Never neglecting you, Dan.
No. Why I see it, the only responsible way to deal with social responsibility is to share it. Anything else is irresponsible. And we share it with democracy, because democracy isn't just a way of organising society. It's also the greatest way that you can have of exchanging ideas.
Hmm. Yeah, if I could say something on that, I mean, it's nothing, I think that hasn't already been said, but just reframing it a little bit, I think when we think of pluralism a lot, we think about a sort of conflict of ideas or values or interests. But of course, there is also a question of how this is going to impact on the population. So underneath that, a democratic attitude is fundamentally is that everyone's lives are equally valuable, which means that it's not just about conflict. It's also about, the democracy is not necessarily about the dominance of the majority. It's not necessarily about any one section sort of being able in any way to gain influence over the other, whose interest therefore will be neglected. It can also be very much about finding ways in which everyone's interest as far as possible is actually met in different ways. So it could be about compromise in that way as well. So yeah, Simon.
I was just going to say about democracy, certainly the socialist notion of democracy. Democracy, some people seem to think that it's a process, but it's not the franchise, real or feigned, that actually makes what a democracy is. Democracy is about power, but it's expressed power. It's like, basically, if I wanted to make the decision, I could. But one of the best ways of stopping someone from having what they want is to put a ribbon roll in front of them of a set of tick boxes or whatever it is, and then talk to this council or whatever, and that's how you stop someone having an effective decision. So to actually think that sort of like a socialist future is going to have a particular organisational form, like the franchise that we have now, is quite ridiculous. But at the same time, so if you look at what the Bordigists are thinking, they're not permitting, it seems, that if I wanted to express my will, I could, of the working class. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. I realise it's become my watchword of union.
Okay. Anyone else? Yeah, Mike.
Thanks. Yeah, really enjoyed that. Really interesting. Just a thought that popped into my head about consensus. And forgive me if I sort of missed it. If you sort of covered this in your talk, I suppose sort of making a decision by consensus is quite easy when you've got a small number of people and a fairly sort of trivial decision, like I don't know which restaurant to go to or something like that. And I suppose in those kinds of situations, you might get someone who makes a point a bit more forcefully than others. Others aren't really bothered and just go with the flow. You might get, someone makes a suggestion, no one can be bothered to disagree because they can't think of another suggestion. You know, those kinds of things which we might call sort of consensus decision making that's not as clear cut as everyone agreeing on a particular line of action. And I suppose, because consensus decisions have got that sort of informality, that they work best, I'd say, in smaller groups. But at the same time, I sort of imagine that a
a post-capitalist society might handle consensus in a perhaps a wider way, given that there'd be fewer, you know, vested interests, other things sort of clogging up decision-making processes when you don't have to take into account, you know, the money system and all the rest of it. So yeah, I was just wondering if you had any thoughts about the value, if any, of consensus, especially in a post-capitalist society, or if something like that would be too woolly, if you like, to have much sort of robustness at all. I don't mean about sort of trivial examples like which restaurant to go to, obviously sort of wider examples where there are sort of you know, ramifications and consequences.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good question, and my instinct, as you suggest in the question, is that that kind of reaching a consensus works better in smaller groups than it does over large numbers of people. If we imagine the kind of question that might come up and that might or might not be a candidate for consensus, you said you didn't want deciding to go to a restaurant. A new pandemic virus, which is the sort of thing that might well crop up in a socialist society, as it has done occasionally in a capitalist society, and a lot of the complications that arose with the COVID-19 pandemic, to do with state power, to do with money and profitability and so on, a lot of those complications would not arise. But you still would have a situation where initially information was imperfect. We don't know quite how dangerous this virus actually is. We don't know quite how effective different countermeasures are or aren't. We don't know how easy it'll be or not be to develop a vaccine. So it might be that on that, a consensus would emerge about what was a sensible level of precaution for society to take. But I think it's also possible that it wouldn't quite reach a consensus, and that you would need some sort of more formalized procedure. I mean, blowing the trumpet for sortition in a very small way. Sortition is just like a jury. That you choose people at random, and we can't get everybody in the room to debate it and maybe get to a consensus, but we can get a hopefully representative sample to debate it and maybe get to a consensus. But I think, again, it's unsatisfactory. Like I was replying unsatisfactorily about who it's worth talking to. It's unsatisfactory to say we'll find out where we get there, how broad the consensus is. But at some point, the answer has to be we'll find out. We'll find out exactly how it works itself out when we get there.
Okay, anyone else before we wind up? Last chance, anyone burning to say something? No? Okay. All right, well, so Edmund, thank you. So on behalf of everyone, can we...